You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Welcome to the fourth in our series of CEU lectures. I'm John Shattuck, the president and rector of Central European University, and it's my great privilege throughout this week to host five lectures by George Soros, held here in Budapest at the Hungarian Academy of Sciences under the auspices of European University. In his lecture today, Mr. Soros will build on the concept of open society that he outlined yesterday, and he will explore the conflict between capitalism and open society and between market values and social values. He will continue his challenge to market fundamentalism while presenting his ideas for protecting the public good. All the CEU lectures this week are being video conferenced to universities on several continents, creating an unprecedented global real-time audience of students. Today's lecture will include students from Fudan University in Shanghai, whom you will meet in a few moments, in addition to the invited guests and CEU students who are here in Budapest. Our moderator today is Mark Danner, an award-winning American journalist and commentator on foreign affairs, politics, and human rights. As he has in previous lectures, Mr. Soros will speak for approximately 50 minutes, following which Mr. Danner will offer his own brief commentary. Mr. Soros will then take questions, starting with three questions from Shanghai, from the students at Fudan University, and then further questions from all of you here in Budapest. Now, to deliver his fourth lecture, I'm delighted once again to introduce George Soros, whose extraordinary performance over the last 3 days provides the best possible introduction to what he will tell us this afternoon.
Thank you. Today, I want to explore the conflict between capitalism and open society, market values and social values. But I'm going to approach the subject indirectly by first introducing a phenomenon that has attracted my attention only recently, but has assumed such importance in my thinking that I am almost inclined to call it the fourth pillar of my conceptual framework. That phenomenon is the principal agent problem. Agents are supposed to represent the interests of their principals, but in fact, they tend to put their own interests ahead of the interests of those whom they are supposed to represent. That's the agency problem. It's been extensively analyzed by economists, but they look at it exclusively in terms of contracts and incentives, and they largely disregard questions of ethics and values. Yet, if you leave the ethical consideration out, the problem becomes pretty well intractable. Values like honesty and integrity lose their grip on people's behavior, and people become increasingly motivated by economic incentives. By claiming to be value-free, market fundamentalism has actually undermined moral values. Markets are supposed to be guided by an invisible hand. That's what makes them so efficient. Participants need to exercise no moral judgments in reaching their buy and sell decisions because their actions are not supposed to have any visible effect on the market prices. In truth, the rules governing financial markets are decided by the visible hand of politicians. And in a representative democracy, politicians run into an agency problem. Thus, the agency problem poses grave difficulties both for representative democracy and the market economy, which can't be resolved without an appeal to moral principles. That's how the agency problem has gained such prominence in my thinking. First, I'll analyze the agency problem, and then I will deal with the conflict between capitalism and open society. Let me start at the beginning. I first encountered the agency problem in connection with the so-called resource curse. By resource curse, I mean that countries that are rich in natural resources are often cursed by corrupt or repressive governments, insurrections, civil wars, so that the people are even poorer and lead more miserable lives than in countries that are less well endowed by nature. Think of the Congo, Sudan, Sierra Leone, and Liberia. One of the non-governmental organizations I support, Global Witness, proposed a campaign based on the slogan, "Publish what you pay." The idea was to get oil companies and mining companies to disclose the payments they make to various governments. The amounts could then be added up, and the governments could be held responsible by the people for the monies they received. The campaign was launched in 2002, and it has had an interesting history. The idea itself turned out to be a fertile fallacy, because while public opinion could put enough pressure on the big oil companies, fly-by-night operators and companies domiciled in non-democratic states were less susceptible. So the amounts could not be added up. Fortunately, the British government took up the cause and formed the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, which brought together governments, companies, and civil society in an effort to establish international standards of transparency, which apply both to companies and to governments. In those countries that subscribed to the Transparency Initiative, the governments undertook to publish the amounts they received. That is actually working in countries like Nigeria and Azerbaijan. In analyzing the resource curse, I came to attribute great importance to what I called an asymmetric agency problem. According to the modern concept of sovereignty, the natural resources of a country belong to the people of that country, but governments, which are supposed to be agents of the people, put their own interests ahead of the interests of the people whom they are supposed to represent and engage in all sorts of corrupt practices. On the opposite side, the managements of the international oil and mining companies represent the interests of the companies all too well. They used to go so far as to bribe governments in order to obtain concessions. Willing takers and givers of bribes are the root cause of the resource curse. Once I became aware of the agency problem, I discovered it everywhere. Communism failed because of the agency problem. Karl Marx's proposition, from everybody according to their ability and to everybody according to their needs, was a very attractive idea, but the communist rulers put their own interests ahead of the interests of the people. The agency problem is also the bane of representative democracy, because the elected representatives use their powers for their own interests to the detriment of the common interest. And in the recent financial crisis, the agency problem proved to be the undoing of the financial system. When financial engineers turned mortgages into securities by issuing collateralized debt obligations or CDOs, they thought they were reducing risks through geographical diversification. In reality, they were introducing a new risk by separating the interests of the agents who created and distributed the synthetic instruments from the interests of the owners of those securities. And the agents were more interested in earning fees than in protecting the interests of the principals. So the agency problem seemed ubiquitous. Yet, in spite of its pervasive influence, it escaped attention until recently. In my student days, it was almost totally unrecognized. In the last 20 years, it has received more attention, but mainly from economists who studied it in terms of contracts and incentives. In reality, the agency problem is more of an ethical problem, and analyzing it in terms of contracts and incentives actually aggravated the ethical problem. Establishing the principle that people's behavior is governed by contracts and incentives had the effect of eliminating or at least diminishing ethical considerations. That may sound perverse, but only because reflexivity is not well understood. Values are less closely governed by an objective reality than cognitive notions. Therefore, they are more easily shaped by the theories that people adopt, and economic theory is a case in point. Markets are supposed to act as an invisible hand, bringing the demand and supply into balance. What makes the invisible hand so efficient is that there is no need to exercise moral judgment. All values can be expressed in terms of money, and money is fungible. Pecunia non olet. Money doesn't smell, the Romans used to say. But taking it for granted that all human behavior is guided by self-interest leaves no room for the exercise of moral judgment, and society can't exist without some ethical precepts. The behavior of market participants is guided by market values, and market values are quite different in character from the moral values that are supposed to guide the behavior of people as members of society. This opens up a whole range of questions which I have not been able to resolve concerning the conflict between market values and social values. The agency problem has provided me with some new insights. I was also inspired by a short monograph by Bruce R. Scott on the concept of capitalism. As a result, I may have something new to say. Indeed, I myself am shocked by some of the conclusions I have reached. Scott argues that capitalism has been misinterpreted by conflating it with the market mechanism. This is a distortion that Scott attributes mainly to Milton Friedman. I'm less specific and attribute it to market fundamentalism. Scott argues further that behind the invisible hand of the market lurks the visible hand of human agency, namely the political process which sets and administers the rules. This is where the agency problem comes into play. So does the conflict between market values and social values. The United States is a democratic, open society based on the freedom of the individual, protected by the rule of law as defined by the Constitution. At the same time, the American economy is based on the market mechanism which allows individuals to engage in free exchange without undue interference from arbitrary actions by governmental authority. The political and economic arrangements seem to fit together seamlessly. One could easily speak of an open society and a market economy in the same breath, and people, including me, often do. But appearances are deceptive. There is a deep-seated conflict between capitalism and open society, market values and social values. The conflict has been successfully covered up by the market fundamentalist ideology, which gained the upper hand in the 1980s during Ronald Reagan's presidency. The distinguishing feature of the market mechanism is that it is amoral. One person's dollar is worth exactly the same as another person's, irrespective of how she came to possess it. That's what makes markets so efficient. Participants needn't worry about moral considerations. In an efficient market, individual decisions affect market prices only marginally. If one person abstained from participating as either buyer or seller, someone else would take her place with only a marginal difference in the price. Therefore, individual market participants bear little responsibility for the outcome. But markets are suitable only for individual choices, not for social decisions. They allow individual participants to engage in free exchange, but they are not designed to exercise social choices, such as deciding the rules that should govern society, including how the market mechanism should function. That's the purview of politics. Extending the idea of a freestanding market, self-governing and self-correcting, to the political sphere is highly deceptive because it removes ethical considerations from politics, which can't properly function without them. In the United States, politics takes the form of representative democracy. People elect representatives who operate the levers of power. They are agents who are supposed to represent the interests of the people. In reality, they tend to put their own interests ahead of the interests of the people. Getting elected is expensive, and representatives are beholden to their supporters. Those who don't play the game, don't get elected. That's how money pollutes politics, and special interests trump the public interest. The agency problem in the American political system is not new. It's inherent in a representative democracy. The right to petition elected representatives was written into the Constitution. Yet, the agency problem seems to be much more severe today than it was even as recently as my arrival in the United States in 1956. Why? There are several objective historical developments which may be held partly responsible, notably the development of sophisticated methods of manipulating public opinion and the growth of special interests. But the main culprit is a decline in public morality fostered by the rise of market fundamentalism. I'd like to think that at the time of the founding of the Republic, citizens were genuinely guided by a sense of civic virtue. Fortunately, the founding fathers didn't put much faith in that and built the Constitution on the division of powers. They created checks and balances between competing interests. That's why the Constitution holds up so well in spite of the decline in morality. Even when I first arrived in 1956, people professed to be guided by intrinsic values like honesty and integrity. It may have been hypocritical with all kinds of vices clandestinely practiced, but still, it was very different from today's public life, where the blatant pursuit of self-interest is openly admitted and people are admired for being successful, irrespective of how they achieved it. I don't want to be misunderstood. Painting too rosy a picture of the past is characteristic of people of a certain age. And I don't want to fall into such an obvious trap. I don't claim that politicians were more honest and society more just in 1956. America has made great progress since then in transparency, accountability, and social equality. But there has been a remarkable transformation in what I believe is the behavior of what is socially acceptable and even admirable due to the rise of market fundamentalism. I describe it as a decline in public morality in a very special sense by contrasting it with the amorality of market values. I define market fundamentalism as the undue extension of market values to other spheres of social life, notably politics. Economic theory claims that in conditions of general equilibrium, the invisible hand assures the optimum allocation of resources. This means that people pursuing their self-interest are indirectly also serving the public interest. It gives self-interest and the profit motive a moral imprimatur, which allows them to replace virtues like honesty, integrity, and concern for others. The argument is invalid on several counts. First, financial markets don't tend towards equilibrium. General equilibrium theory reached its conclusion by taking the conditions of supply and demand as independently given. The invisible hand of the market then brings supply and demand into equilibrium. This approach ignores the reflexive feedback loops between market prices and the underlying conditions of supply and demand. It also ignores the visible hand of the political process, which lies hidden behind the market mechanism. Second, the general equilibrium theory takes the initial allocation of resources as given. This rules out any consideration of social justice. Most importantly, the theory assumes that people know what their self-interest is and how best to pursue it. In reality, there is a significant gap between what people think and what the facts are. Nevertheless, market fundamentalism has emerged triumphant. How could that happen? One reason is that the main policy implication of market fundamentalism, that government interference in the economy should be kept to a minimum, is not as unsound as the arguments employed to justify it. The market mechanism may be flawed, but the political process is even more so. Participants in the political process are even more fallible than market participants because politics revolve around social values, whereas markets take the participants' values as given. As we have seen, social values are highly susceptible to manipulation. Moreover, politics are poisoned by the agency problem. To guard against the agency problem, all kinds of safeguards have to be introduced, and this makes the behavior of governmental agencies in the economic sphere much more rigid and bureaucratic than the behavior of private participants. On all these grounds, it makes sense to argue that governmental interference in the economy should be kept to a minimum. So, market fundamentalism has merely substituted an invalid argument for what could have been a much stronger one. It could have argued that all human constructs are imperfect and social choices involve choosing the lesser evil, and on those grounds, government intervention in the economy should be kept to a minimum. That would have been a reasonable position. Instead, it claimed that the failures of government intervention proved that the free markets are perfect, and that's simply bad logic. I want to make myself quite clear. I condemn market fundamentalism as a false and dangerous doctrine, but I'm in favor of keeping government intervention and regulations to a minimum for other and better reasons. By far the most powerful force working in favor of market fundamentalism is that it serves the self-interests of the owners and managers of capital. The distribution of wealth is taken as given, and the pursuit of self-interest is found to serve the common interest. What more could those who are in control of capital ask for? They constitute a wealthy and powerful group, well-positioned to promote market fundamentalism, not only by cognitive argument, but by the active manipulation of public opinion. Market fundamentalism endows the market mechanism, which is amoral by nature, with a moral character, and turns the pursuit of self-interest into a civic virtue similar to the pursuit of truth. It has prevailed by the force of manipulation, not by the force of reason. It's supported by a powerful and well-financed propaganda machine which distorts the public's understanding of its own self-interests. For example, how else could the campaign to repeal the estate tax, which applies only to an elite 1% of the population, have been so successful? There are, of course, competing forces in the political arena that use similar methods of manipulation, but they tend to be less well-financed because they can't draw on the self-interest of the wealthiest and most powerful segment of the population. That's how market fundamentalism has emerged triumphant in the last 25 years. And even the financial crisis was not sufficient to impair its influence. This was demonstrated by President Obama's decision to avoid recapitalizing the banks in a way that would have given the government majority control. Market fundamentalism should not be conflated with the efficient market hypothesis. You can be an economist working on that hypothesis or with that hypothesis without being a market fundamentalist. Indeed, many economists are bleeding heart liberals, but The efficient market hypothesis has a stranglehold on the teaching of economics in American universities, and that phenomenon can be attributed to the financial support given by capitalists and foundations committed to market fundamentalism. They are also responsible for the encroachment of market values into other disciplines like law and political science. Capitalism is not directly opposed to open society the way Soviet communism was. Nevertheless, it poses some serious threats. I've already discussed one of them. The financial markets are not equilibrium bound, but bubble prone. The dismantling of the regulatory mechanism has given rise to a super bubble whose bursting will negatively influence the American economy for several years to come. This discussion has revealed another threat to open society, the agency problem and the influence of money in politics, which contaminate the political process. In an open society, the political process is supposed to serve the common interest. In contemporary America, the political process has been captured by special interests. Our elected representatives are beholden to those who finance their election, not to the electorate at large. What's happening to President Obama's health care and energy bills provides a vivid illustration. The electorate has been brainwashed to such an extent that a responsible discussion of the public good has become well nigh impossible. A national health service and a carbon tax are non-starters. Our choices are confined to solutions that can be gamed by special interests, such as cap and trade. Lobbying is at the core of the agency problem. How can it be brought under control? This is an ethical issue and not a matter of modifying economic incentives, because lobbying is lucrative and it's liable to remain so even if the rules are tightened. In the absence of moral values, regulations can always be circumvented. And what's worse, the regulations themselves will be designed to serve special interests, not the common interest. This is the danger facing the United States today, when a wounded financial sector is seeking to regain its former preeminence. There is a way to deal with the ethical issue. We need to draw a clear distinction between the economic and political spheres. Market participation and rulemaking are two different functions. Markets allow participants to engage in free exchange. Here, it's quite legitimate for the participants to be guided by the profit motive. By contrast, the making and enforcement of rules ought to be guided by consideration of the public good. Here, the profit motive is misplaced. It's when people try to bend the rules to their own advantage that the political process becomes corrupted and representative democracy fails to produce the results that would make open society a desirable form of social organization. It should be emphasized that this argument directly contradicts the currently fashionable market fundamentalist attitude, which speaks of a political marketplace. How could the political process be improved in an open society? I propose a rather simple rule. People should separate their role as market participants from their role as political participants. As market participants, they ought to pursue their self-interest. As participants in the political process, they ought to be guided by the public interest. The justification for this rule is also rather simple. If in conditions close to perfect competition, no single competitor can affect the market prices. Therefore, individual market decisions have no effect on social conditions, whether or not one cares about the common good. But political decisions do affect social conditions. Therefore, it makes all the difference whether or not they serve the public interest. The trouble is that the public good can't be determined by reference to a generally accepted objective standard. It's contingent on the views of the electorate, but in the absence of an objective standard, these views are easily manipulated. And manipulation is self-reinforcing. The more outrageous the political claims and counterclaims, the harder it is to tell what is right and what is wrong. That's what has made the political process so ineffective in the United States today. By contrast, the market mechanism functions much better. People may not know what's good for them, but profits do provide an objective criterion by which market participants' performance can be measured. No wonder that the profit motive has gained such prominence among the values that guide people's behavior. Not only do profits provide the means for the pursuit of whatever ends people may have, but they also serve as an end in itself, because as a reliable measure of success, they attract other people's admiration and generate self-esteem. Indeed, many successful business people feel much more secure in making money than in using their wealth. The spread of market values has brought immense economic benefits in the course of history. Looking back, Christianity used to treat the pursuit of profit as sinful. This hampered economic development. The Reformation then facilitated the development of markets and opened the way to material progress and the accumulation of wealth. Society underwent a great transformation. Traditional relationships were replaced by contractual ones. Contractual relations came to penetrate into more and more spheres of social life, and eventually relationships started to be replaced by transactions. The pace of change continued to accelerate. It spread up tremendously during my lifetime. The difference between my childhood in Hungary and my adult life in America is quite dramatic. So were the changes that occurred in America between my arrival in 1956 and the present day. When I first came to America, I was struck by how much further market values had penetrated into society than in my native Hungary, or even England, where traditional values and class distinctions still prevailed. Since then, both England and America underwent a further transformation. The professions like medicine and law became businesses. In my view, this has had a destabilizing effect on society, just as market fundamentalism has had a destabilizing effect on financial markets. Now, exactly what level of stability is socially desirable is, of course, a matter of opinion. What is the proper role of the profit motive in the professions, such as law and medicine, and the media, is similarly open to debate. But there can be no question that the profit motive has had a nefarious influence in the political sphere, because it has aggravated the agency problem. Now, how can the agency problem be minimized? It's too much to expect those who have a vital special interest at stake not to lobby Congress. The tobacco industry is bound to oppose legislation against cigarettes, and the insurance industry will be against a single-payer healthcare system. But those who don't have a vital interest at stake ought to give precedence to the public interest over their narrow self-interest. They needn't be bothered by the so-called free rider problem, namely that others who act more selfishly would also benefit from their unselfish behavior because the objective of the exercise is to benefit the public. To sum up, yesterday I argued that the cognitive function ought to be given precedence over the manipulative function. Today, I argue that while the profit motive is perfectly justified within the existing rules, when it comes to making the rules, the public interest ought to be given precedence over personal interests. I firmly believe that if a minority of the electorate met those two requirements, representative democracy would function better. Now, I realize that this is perhaps a politically incorrect, elitist point of view, because I attribute great importance to an elite that is devoted to the pursuit of truth and devoted to the public interest. But I firmly believe that that is what we need for an open society to flourish and actually even to survive. Now, I'd like to end on a personal note. I have practiced what I preach. As a hedge fund manager, I have played by the rules and tried to maximize my profits. As a citizen, I try to improve the rules, even if the reforms go against my personal interests. For instance, I support the regulation of hedge funds, along with other financial institutions. I firmly believe that if more people followed this precept, our political system would function much better. I also believe that foundations like mine can play an important role exactly because so few people follow that precept. In the Open Society Institute, we have made it our business to protect the public interest against the encroachments of private interests. We are also supporting civil society in holding governments accountable. I would describe these endeavors as political philanthropy, and I believe that it can make a greater contribution to make the world a better place than more conventional philanthropy because fewer people are engaged in it. I'm in a privileged position. I'm more independent than most people because I don't depend on clients or customers, and I feel under a moral obligation to put my privileged position to good use. I'm, of course, greatly outgunned by special interests, but at least I have the satisfaction that my money has greater scarcity value. The trouble is that special interests also seek to disguise themselves as protectors of the public interest, and it takes a discerning eye to discriminate between the genuine and the phony, especially as both sides are forced to resort to similar methods of persuasion and manipulation. In the absence of objective criteria, one can only reach a judgment by a process of trial and error. People of good intentions engaged on one side of the debate often find it difficult to believe that there are people on the other side with equally good intentions. The best way to find out is by taking their claims at face value and engaging them on the substance of their argument. This has the beneficial effect of giving the cognitive function precedence in the political debate. Only if they fail to respond in kind should they be dismissed and subsequently ignored. There are people like that in every country. Unfortunately, in the United States, they are not ignored. They have become very influential. Whether the electorate also refuses to be influenced by people who try to manipulate them with total disregard for the truth is the test that every open society has to pass to remain open. Given the success of Orwellian propaganda, America is not doing very well in this regard. The political process, which has served America well for two centuries, seems to have deteriorated. We used to have two parties competing for the middle, but the middle ground has shrunk, and politics have become increasingly polarized. President Obama has done his level best to reverse the trend. He has tried to be the great uniter, but to no avail. In the end, how a democracy functions depends on the people who live in it. I believe that if more people separated their role as political participants from their role as market participants, American democracy would function much better. It's up to each individual. That's what I have done, and even a small minority could be helpful in rebuilding the vanishing middle ground. Thank you.
There is a deep-seated conflict between capitalism and the open society. I want to start with that rather striking quotation from George Soros's extremely rich and provocative talk to let those words reverberate once again through the hall in their clarity, but also in their radicalism. We're standing here in Budapest almost precisely 20 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And I remember vividly that time 20 years ago when the talk in the United States was not only about the inevitability of capitalism and democracy, because those two go obviously hand in hand, but the assumption and the argument that the combination of those two systems, if you will, political and economic, constituted the end of history, to use the title of the famous essay by Francis Fukuyama. Fukuyama was arguing, borrowing ideas from Kojève and Hegel, that the fall of the wall beckoned a new age in which capitalism and democracy, working hand in hand, would essentially take over the world. Well, we know that history didn't end. We know about the Balkans, Rwanda, the Gulf War, the Iraq War. There's been a great deal of history since then, but it is striking to find in this place expressed by a key figure in world capitalism and world finance the notion that democracy and the open society are, as they exist today, incompatible. I want to seize on my rights as moderator and reconceive this question a little bit as a reporter as well in terms of power versus the open society. I was reminded, thinking as George spoke, of a time in 1987 when I was covering the Haitian election, which was supposed to bring the transition of democracy to Haiti after a long dictatorship and turned out to be a bloody disaster in which the people with power confronted the challenge of all of these people standing there ready to vote by sending gunmen to murder them, murdering a couple of hundred of them, as it turned out. I remember thinking at the time that our vision of democracy is, at its heart, a kind of beautiful myth. It proposes that on one sacred day, everyone in the society, the powerless and the powerful, the poor and the wealthy, stand together with exactly the same amount of power. They have the power of one vote. But of course, that day does not change power relations within a society. In Haiti, the powerful pay gunmen wielding Uzis and machetes to go and kill voters. In the United States, the powerful pay lobbyists to lobby Congress, pay ad men to make advertisements, pay political candidates to run their campaigns. Trying to press down power in one place is like pressing down on water in a lake. It rises somewhere else. It seems to me then that the heart of this problem has to do with our conception of the open society, particularly as George has set it out to you today and in the previous lectures, and I want to press him a little bit on this issue. Because the open society we're talking about, which he said is supposed to or exists to promote the public good, in fact was not set up that way. The famous framers of the Constitution put together a system whose major function was to divide government power, balance it one part against the other, and to try to clear a private space in which government power could not dominate. A good example is the famous First Amendment. We've heard today about brainwashing, about the manipulation of the public, the use of the press to do that. We all know how this has happened and is happening in the United States. The fact is, though, when we look at the famous First Amendment, what do we find? We find no right to truth. We find no right to enlightenment. We find no right to know, although we hear that phrase used often. The full text of the First Amendment as regards freedom of the press reads as follows: Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of the press. That is, it is a limitation on government vis-a-vis the press. It says nothing about private forces. And indeed, the press is a collection of private institutions, money-making institutions, that can indeed be manipulated. It also says nothing about restraining private power from influencing politics through elections. So I would say today, and I'd like to ask George about this, doesn't our problem really have to do with renovating our open society as it exists in ways that will conceive of it less as a neutral arbitrator and more of an active power trying to assure what George called the common good? Now, this may sound like a radical proposal. In fact, we've had 100 years of fighting over precisely this issue within the United States. One example, boring as it is campaign finance reform. George said it's very, and rightly said, it's extremely expensive to get elected. Elected officials feel that they owe fealty to those who paid for their campaigns. This is obviously true. But in fact, there's nothing inherently expensive about getting elected. 70% of the cost of running for office is buying television time. The airwaves belong to the public. The government has absolutely the right to require, although it can't limit, according to the Supreme Court, it can't limit what private agents give to candidates. It can require the airwaves, the broadcast and cable networks, to give space for free to candidates. That is something absolutely conceivable, absolutely doable. It can also, when we talk about the press, can not only ensure public access to the airwaves, public broadcasting and so on, it can require a certain degree of truth-telling and fairness. And I say this not as an active proposal, but as a matter of history. Franklin Roosevelt, of course, in his regulation of broadcasting back in the 30s, then radio, but it was inherited by the television industry, imposed a fairness doctrine, which essentially said both sides, at least, need to be heard. He also imposed a public interest requirement. Each year, the television networks had to make a case to the licensing board that they had served the public interest. This was usually taken to mean that the news divisions of broadcast networks would be protected from the profit motive, which is to say they were loss leaders. They spent a great deal of money. They did it. The networks thought, well, we have to do this to serve the public interest. Now, this was a real thing that actually expired in real time. This expired under the Reagan administration. So these things could very easily be put back into effect. There are a lot of other obvious proposals we could make in which the Open Society would become an affirmative supporter of the common good and a countervailing force to market power. Let me say my time is short. Let me just make a couple of brief other points. Well, let me make a final point, which is this. George has suggested that people need to divide their private interests from their political interests. He offers himself as an example, and it's a very vivid one. I would suggest, though, that the proposal that we produce many, many George Soroses and have a kind of truth-telling squad is going to be a very difficult thing to do because he's a very unusual person. I also think that trying to establish a group of truth-tellers compared yesterday to a platonic idea, that is, we're talking about guardians of the public good who would be trained to observe, to critique, and to lead the public, will not in the end be a practical idea. I think and I will be interested to hear his views of this, what needs to be done is a program of reformation of the original conception of an open society. And many of these proposals are absolutely conceivable, absolutely doable. President Obama has talked about, for example, bringing back the Fairness Doctrine. There's a great deal of opposition to it. And one should observe that the very forces that you've detailed so well and so richly in your talk militate against the very reforms that I am suggesting. I understand that. Nonetheless, I am optimistic about it. And I would ask you whether we shouldn't really be looking for systemic reform more than private reform. Thank you.
Very good. I think we should go to ask them to comment, and we can go after.
I will indeed.
Okay.
George suggests that we ask the students and faculty at Fudan University in Shanghai to begin with their comments. And so I say hello to our friends in Shanghai and welcome them, invite them to ask the first question.
Okay, hello from Fudan University, Shanghai. Thanks a lot for this fascinating lecture. And I'm the local facilitator, and we already have three questions, two from faculty members and one from student. Now I'm handing it over to the first participant.
Okay. Yeah. Hello, George. I'm Wei-Sin Lee from the School of Economics. I meet you this. Just one question. In the conclusion, you said, I believe that if more people separated their role as political participants from their role of market participants, the American democracy will function better. I agree with your standpoint, but I just wonder one question. That's if I'm not misunderstanding what you say. If without the representative democracy, or in James Buchanan's jargon, the constitutional democracy, the separation of two roles you proposed could be implemented or not. That's, you know, just like that two rules is closely linked together. That's all the questions of Chinese society face today. That's my question. Thank you.
I believe he asked, you got the question about the separation of two worlds?
Yes. It's a very interesting question.
You might restate it for the audience.
For once, I understood it very well. I suggest separating the two roles. How should that apply in China, where
you don't have a representative democracy. And I think it's a very, very interesting question, and it's much more difficult, I think, to apply it in China, because China is a very efficient a system of decision-making, but it is characterized by a much greater political influence over economic decisions. Effectively, investment decisions are mainly guided by political considerations rather than by the profit motive. It is in many ways efficient, but the problem then of using personally or making decisions for personal interest rather than the public interest is very great, the temptation. And of course, corruption is the big factor in China that limits the success of the Chinese model. It's really the main problem. And I think that actually moving towards a more open society, and giving the people more rights to stand up and to express their views, establishing proper channels, establishing the rule of law rather than the rule of men, is the direction in which China needs to go in order to improve the efficiency of investment, because it's remarkable how low the rate of return on investment in China is. It's actually quite amazing given China's success. But then more than 50% of the GNP actually goes into investment. But the rate of return on that investment is very low.
Given if you conceive of private interests having a determining effect on public policy as corruption, if we define it that way, is China more corrupt than the United States?
I would say that corruption is endemic in the system. In the United States, it's really mainly in the political arena that the lobbying and special interests influencing the regulations that are enacted. That's where mainly the distortion comes into play. Whereas in China, it pervades the economic system itself.
Why don't we go to our second question from Fudan University.
Mr. Solos, now we have the second question.
Hello, this is Yu Peng, a student from Fudan University. My question would be, agencies and representatives somehow are made up, and most of the times, of elites. And at the same time, you're suggesting the separation of the roles of participants in the politics and participants in the market was somehow sent a negative message to those elites, and which somehow indicated by the history that we're going to see more catastrophic effects. As predicted, maybe we would see more financial meltdowns in the future. So my question would be, how effective do you think your suggestion, the separation of roles, would play in the future? Thank you.
Could you just repeat the question?
I think it's a question about whether the separation of public and private roles that you suggested would play a distinctly negative role on the elites and would have a negative effect on their functioning as economic agents. That's how he formed the question.
If you separate it, it would have a negative effect
on elites in playing their role as economic agents of the private sector.
I don't understand the question. It doesn't make sense to me, frankly.
It could be reconceived as, do the elites need market fundamentalism and their influence on the public sector to function profitably?
They must be motivated by self-interest in order to be making the rules. Mm-hmm. I don't see that. I think that certainly in a well-functioning democracy, that has not been the case.
Well, let me put it in a different form. If what your vision that you set out was enacted, would we have as one final result a more equal distribution of wealth?
I think that depends on the will of the electorate.
You mentioned the estate tax, which was abolished, even though it was absolutely contrary to the interests of 99% of the population. The implication being, if people really understood what it involved, abolishing it wouldn't have been abolished.
You are right. Actually, given the influence of market fundamentalism, the success of market fundamentalism in America, which has really kind of skewed public opinion against their own interest. Mm-hmm. I quoted the estate tax as a very good example. Certainly, if you eliminated that, then I think the public interest would be better served, and presumably it would lead to a more equal distribution of wealth. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to prejudge it, because let's say I happen to be in that camp mm-hmm. politically that would favor a more equal a distribution. But I don't want to impose my judgment and claim it that that's how open society has to be. I think that is really up to the people in the democracy concerned to make that decision.
I would press you just a little on that before going back to Fudan, because isn't that a bit of an imposed neutrality? I mean, really what you're saying is that the public interest should be more equitably represented, the broader public interest. And I would think that would suggest that the great concentrations of wealth we've seen in recent years would to some extent be reversed. No?
Well, look, again, the evidence points out that the differences in income have tremendously increased in the last 25 years when market fundamentalism has become the dominant mm-hmm. creed. And in fact, the average has not benefited. It's really the top 1 or 2% of the population that gathered all the extra revenues that came from a benefit. So that's, and therefore, if you reversed it, presumably it would go the other way. But mm-hmm. I still don't think. I just don't want to. I agree with that argument, but I don't want to pose that as sort of the open society, yes. Because I would be prejudging it, which is not appropriate.
We'll go back now to Fudan University in Shanghai. Third question.
Okay, thank you very much. And the third question from myself. My name is Pei Shun, Associate Professor in School of Management, Fudan University. I think the title of the lecture is Capitalism versus Open Society. And one of the central messages conveyed from this lecture seems that the rise of market fundamentalism is a major threat to open society. So my question is, what's the relationship between capitalism and market fundamentalism? And put it another way, under what conditions, under what circumstances, the right will market fundamentalism will develop and even flourish in a capitalist society? Thank you.
Could you repeat that?
Well, I thought he was getting, and I may have misunderstood, to the fact that capitalism doesn't necessarily need democracy as a partner. That is what I understood the beginning of the question meant, that in fact, and he is coming, of course, from Shanghai, one of the most powerful cities in a country that is both vividly capitalist and non-democratic. But I am afraid I didn't understand the very last line of the question. Maybe you could repeat it. I simply didn't understand what you said.
The last line.
Just the last line.
Market fundamentalism may now develop quite fastly in capitalist society because market fundamentalism is not equal to capitalism. So, but you in the lecture you said that in the United States, market fundamentalism even flourished over the last several decades in such a particular capitalist society. So my question is, under what conditions, so under what circumstances, market fundamentalism will develop or flourish in a capitalist society?
Under what situations does market fundamentalism flourish in capitalist societies?
Yes. Look,
thank you.
Thank you very much for that question. It's a very good question. I don't think that market fundamentalism has served capitalism or even the people who espouse that philosophy or ideology very well. Because, as I tried to argue in my previous lectures, it has been responsible for the super bubble, which burst with tremendous damage to the American economy. I think that, for instance, right now, after the bursting of the bubble, when the financial system is being allowed to earn its way out of a hole, to rebuild its capital through hidden subsidies, by keeping making capital available, financing available from the central bank at zero cost, when you can then invest, the banks can invest it with no risk whatsoever into government bonds earning 3.5% and not actually requiring any capital reserves to do that. So they are being effectively given over a hidden subsidy. And at the same time, the banks are now paying a very large bonuses to their employees who are supposed to be generating those earnings by taking risks successfully, in other words, making the right decisions. Here they are just benefiting from a hidden subsidy, and I think it's a big mistake for them actually to use that money in that way because it generates public resentment. So I think it's a very short-sighted view on the part of the market fundamentalists to persist in putting their private interests ahead of the public interest.
I'd like to thank our participants at Fudan University.
Maybe we can come back later.
Maybe we will come back at the end. We'll throw the questions now open to the floor. And as we reach one, I'm going to ask you one quick question to bridge this, which is the policy that you just identified that the Obama regime has, or the Obama administration, excuse me, has pursued. Was it the result of too much private interest on public policy? Did they make this decision as a result of the influence of capital, or did they simply not know how to take the other course that you described?
Well, I think there are two elements. One, that they
basically judged. It was a conscious political decision because there was this alternative. For simplicity's sake, you may call it the Scandinavian solution and the Japanese solution, because the Scandinavians effectively nationalized their banks temporarily,
in Sweden,
and they yeah. got out of a crisis pretty mm-hmm. fast, and of course denationalized the banks, whereas the Japanese supported their banking system through hidden subsidies, and basically the Obama administration decided to go the Japanese mm-hmm. route, and that was partly, I think, a conscious decision. That politically it would be unacceptable, that in fact this anti-government sentiment in and tradition in America is too strong mm-hmm. For them to go against it. And secondly, I think it, in a way there was a certain sequence. The crisis hit, the previous administration took this road of indirect subsidies, and they weren't prepared with the alternative. Mm-hmm. So continuity dragged them in. So partly it was deliberate, and partly it was just the shortness of time. Or time pressure that led to that.
And partly out of not wanting to oppose the ideological beliefs of the
and
American
of course,
population.
And of course, Obama wanted to be the great uniter and did mm-hmm. not want to impose a start off by being too critical of what went before. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a mistake, because you have had 25 years of accumulated excess that came home to roost, but by claiming to arrest the decline, he has actually now taken possession.
And there is an argument for doing the heaviest lifting politically at the beginning when you have the greatest political capital.
Right.
Questions? Sir, over there. Wait for the microphone, please. And tell us your name.
My name is George Kopitz, and I'm a chairman of the Fiscal Council in the Republic of Hungary, and I also lecture at your university, Central European University here in Budapest. First of all, I would like to start by thanking George Soros for an extremely stimulating and thought-provoking presentation. And then thereafter, I would like to just take a little bit of an issue with your observation of the U.S. Agency problem through the last 50 years or the last 100 years. There was an observer of the U.S. Senate in the early, I don't remember who it was, Mencken or who it was, who observed that the price of a senator in the U.S. was about $1,000. Of course, it was much more today's prices than what it is today, right? Yeah. But anyway, there was certainly a lot of agency problem in the early part and in the course of the... I don't think that we are any less moral or less corrupt a society today as at the beginning of the century, but we could go on with that. In any case, you refer to the fact that you need checks and balances, in fact, a lot of institutional framework made up of a lot of watchdogs to watch over the honesty of government. And certainly in the U.S., there has been a lot of institutions created since that time, in the course of even the last 50 years, but going further back, the Federal Trade Commission, Securities and Exchange Commission, 1975, the Congressional Budget Office, and then, of course, even before the General Accounting Office, which then became the General Accountability Office, all of this to serve precisely the purpose that you have described. In fact, we in Hungary, and myself, I'm heading a very new institution, which is more or less patterned after the Congressional Budget Office, to keep the government honest in fiscal policy. But my question really is looking forward a little bit and drawing from already some of your remarks today and elsewhere in media, what sort of institutions do you think would really serve the U.S., and of course we could extend that onto Europe, what sort of institutions would really serve this extremely useful purpose of watching over the financial system?
Thank
if you could, it's...
What institutions?
What sort of institutions would serve the purpose of watching over the financial institutions?
Look, I think that America actually has all the institutions that it needs. It really has a wonderful constitution that, in spite of a few maybe things where it's maybe out of date, like the First Amendment stands in the way of controlling spending on elections and things like that, which the Founding Fathers didn't anticipate, couldn't anticipate 200 years in advance. So there are a few things like that. But on the whole, the institutions are really there. It's really the values that I think have gotten skewed and distorted through this the triumph of market fundamentalism. And I've pointed out the contradictions, the internal contradictions in those values. So I hold values responsible, not institutions. I think we've got the institutions, which is in contrast, let's say, to countries in Eastern Europe, which are relatively young and the institutions are not strong enough.
Questions? Yes, sir? Up. There's the microphone.
After.
I'm Fred Brantman. I'm a writer. I used to work with, excuse me, with folks like Larry Summers and Paul Krugman and so forth, and concluded then, and have seen nothing to change it since, that, and I'm curious what you think of this, that we've entered a phase of late capitalism, high debts, uncompetitive industry, major financial institutions which no longer serve the public interest, which make our previous economic theories that worked in the past irrelevant today, fundamentally, and that America cannot grow as it's grown in the past, and that therefore we really have no choice but to start thinking about accepting that fact, accepting that the real model for America, the future, has to be a European-style welfare state if it can't grow as it has in the past, and if it's not going to fall apart into warring camps, that we need to start promoting values of at least voluntary simplicity, if not just accepting that we're all going to have to live more simply. We are going to have a major redistribution of wealth and fundamentally change the very image of where we're heading rather than, as I think we are now doing, hoping to recover the past. One last comment on that is I think when you really look at the level of debt that we've taken out and the fact that we simply can't repay it under any conceivable scenario for the next 10 or 20 years without a very robust set of industries that are bringing new wealth into America, which we can't see, and we think of what must be done to solve global warming and to deal with an aging baby boom generation that's going to eat up an increasing amount of, or need an increasing amount of entitlements. I'm wondering what you think of this notion that we really have to stop, close with the past, except we're in a late capitalist phase, and start thinking of totally new solutions to which the old solutions
Thank
are
you.
Relevant. Thank
I, th-
you,
I think we get the idea. Are we in a late capitalist phase that can only be confronted with a European welfare-style system and a major redistribution of wealth?
No, look, that's your view, but it's not necessarily the view in America. To say that, I mean, you're right in the sense that the European welfare state has actually weathered this storm very well compared to the United States. And while people, particularly in America, who used to be very critical of the welfare state and the relatively low rate of growth as measured in GNP, effectively, there has been a payoff because the automatic stabilizers have actually really done their job. And hopefully this will influence American opinion looking forward. But as I say, I think you're sort of seeking to impose your views on America, and I don't think that's a practical proposition.
Next question is in the second row here. Can you bring the microphone, please? And then back there. Thank you.
Mr. Soros, in the framework of an open society, how do you analyze Mr. Obama's health program proposition?
How would you analyze President Obama's health proposition, particularly with respect to the prosperity and the problems in the economy?
Well, I've been quite distressed by the debate because the unfortunately the health system proposed by Obama really is not designed to provide health. It's designed to pay for procedures, and it encourages then procedures, not the preservation or promotion of health. So it's fundamentally flawed. And I have no doubt that what you need is a national health service, a single provider, because only a single provider can be concerned about prevention as distinct from treating disease. That is a non-starter, as I said in my lecture. This is absolutely national health, socialism has been outlawed in America. I find that rather distressing.
May I ask a follow-up here? Why, if indeed everyone is insured, and if it's in the interest of health insurance companies, since they can't reject people when they're sick, to have them healthier because they will then spend less money curing them, why cannot the system Obama is now championing also value health?
Because the people can move from one to provider to another. Mm-hmm. So you don't have the... If you have one provider, then the provider is concerned about having fewer procedures. If you have many providers, you don't have the same situation. So I think, quite apart from the fact also that having the insurance companies compete with each other, the only way they can improve their profits is actually by denying benefits.
Procedures.
So you've got the wrong incentives mm-hmm. built into the system.
Okay. Back there.
My name is Julia Varadi, and I'm a journalist, a Hungarian journalist. And if you don't mind, I stay a little bit in this country. Even if we have 20 years of so-called democracy and capitalism, we are beginners, and therefore my question might be naive. But do you think there is anybody, maybe you are the only one, I think, who could convince people who are playing a role in the market not to be influenced by politics, or people who are playing a role in politics not to try to influence the market? I agree with Mr. Danner that George Soros should be multiplied, but until he is not, I doubt that there are too many people who can be convinced about the so-called open society, this phenomenon we are waiting for so much. Thank you.
How do you convince people given that there aren't, you can't multiply George Soros, how do you convince people to separate their private interests and their public interests?
Well, by giving a lecture like this.
Is everybody in the room convinced? Is that the answer? Moral suasion. That is.
What else? I mean, hopefully arguments can still convince people.
We hope that is the case. Let's see, gentleman in the front here.
There was the people there.
Yes, and we'll go over to the side next.
Howard Robinson, Central European University, and it's really a follow-up on the last question. You emphasized, as it were, the division within individuals, but a certain kind of Platonism and old-fashioned Toryism also had that a division between certain classes of person. So in Disraeli's Sybil, for example, you have a civilized commercial society because the aristocracy, the church, and the monarchy don't have direct commercial values. In England, this was passed on through the public schools to the middle class and the professions, and with Keynesianism to the state sector. Is there any way of restoring, not merely hoping people will be schizophrenically honest, but having whole sectors of society who don't from moment to moment make all their decisions on commercial basis? Mrs. Thatcher destroyed that in Britain. How can we restore that?
How can we restore parts of society like the church, the aristocracy, that have built into their traditions a societal responsibility divorced from pursuit of gain and pursuit of wealth?
I mean, I don't believe that you can, this trap of idealizing the past. I try to resist it. I can't totally resist it because I see a deterioration in our values. But I think we need to reconstitute it in some new form and not hark back to the past. It was actually, I think, in the case of British democracy, the aristocracy played a very positive role. But that was that particular historic situation. So I think we need to create a new one. And I think it's not impossible.
On this side? Yes, right there.
Ellen Hume from CEU. I wanted to go back to the question that we got from China, which I don't think was fully recognized, which is, why is market fundamentalism so powerful in the States? How did it become the current philosophy that's so strong? And could there be circumstances that it might happen, for example, in China as well? How do we look for the hallmarks that create this market fundamentalism that you find so negative?
No, look, I tried to explain in my lecture that the main power of market fundamentalism has been the very well financed propaganda. And in fact, there's been some studies that showed how seven foundations, yeah, played a very big role in spreading the market values to areas where they don't belong, as, for instance, law and economics. Mm. And there's a typical example that was basically introduced by financial support for that approach. So I think that is, in my opinion, why it has been so successful. And I think that this moment, when it has so conspicuously done so much damage because of its instability, is the moment to bring home that it has in fact failed and we have to abandon it.
I think it is worth pointing out that this was, in a sense, a premeditated decision brought about by the Powell memo and certain other things by think tanks to spread this. One should also mention, I think, the high inflation and terrible economic situation at the end of the Carter administration, which led the ground for the acceptance of this sort of radical view of capitalism.
Well, the inflation of the 70s has had the effect of discrediting Keynesian economics, mm-hmm. And allowing the monetarist and efficient market hypothesis, etc., to come to the fore.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, sir. And then we'll go to the back.
I'm Gerhard Kasper, a trustee. George, I would like to comment on your last point and really disagree with you to a very large extent. Yes, there were those foundations, Olin and so on, that gave money to universities. But I think that is actually a very misleading understanding of what really happened. And Robert Skidelsky, in a new book that he just published weeks ago, is taking a different take. He is saying it's really the power of ideas. And lots of the ideas we now associate with the Chicago School were very powerful. Many of the participants remained ordinary, relatively poor in genteel poverty, to be sure, but relatively poor academics. That was never the issue. But these ideas seem to have a tremendous attraction because they seem to work for a whole variety of problems, including the assumption of the rational consumer and so on. Now, I happen to agree with most of your criticisms, but I think the notion that it was a kind of conspiracy on the part of wealthy foundations misleads us completely. Yesterday, there was reference to the Platonic elites and were you not going back to it. Well, the dismal news is there are elites, there are Platonic elites, and it could be the Chicago School of Economics. And so we could indeed go in totally undesirable directions. And we should forestall that. And since I do have, the microphone, I would like to go back to the earlier question about institutions. I do believe what you are doing, this lecture, preaching, as it were, is very important and needs to be done. But in the end, it is only the quality of our institutions and the engagement in these institutions, the journalists who are permanently drumming and saying, hey, you're not doing it right, you are keeping information from us, and so on and so on. That will get us improvements. I think hoping for the day when the ordinary citizen will overcome self-interest and will act only in the public interest, assuming we can define it, the public interest. You yourself are very reluctant, actually, in many areas to define what the public interest is. Only then I would put my trust in those solutions rather than in a big moral reformation, and that that includes Hungary too.
I will seize the chance to self-interestedly put forward the critiques, because they follow directly from what you said, that I put forward in my remarks, which is, are there not institutions that could be encouraged aggressively to be renovated, in effect, because many of them already exist, that can at least help the moral suasion you're talking about? I'm talking about the fairness doctrine, electoral reform, limitation on campaign spending, public spending on campaigns. A lot of the problems you pointed to do have conceivable solutions beyond persuasion in the moral realm.
No, undoubtedly, there are reforms. Certainly, campaign finance reform is very much needed. But the fact is that every reform has some flaw in it. Mm-hmm. And I was a supporter of campaign finance reform, particular aspects of it and so on. But I also gave a grant to the New York University Brennan Center, and I said I would want you to study the flaws, the potential flaws in the reform proposals. That part of the grant was actually never used. In other words, they didn't actually do a very good job. Uh-huh. We have to recognize that
all our arrangements are flawed. This is the human condition. And of course, you're right that that Chicago School had a tremendous intellectual power and influence. But you see, a school of thought which basically said that government is bad actually leads to bad government. So there is this reflexive connection as well. In other words, there are booms and busts intellectual development. Mm-hmm. So Keynes, for instance, had a tremendous boom. The Keynesians did not have actually the subtlety of mind of Keynes. Mm-hmm. Just as Marxists didn't quite have, you know, Marxist intelligence either.
Who could? Yes.
So Keynesianism got a little bit overdone, and basically Keynes proposed his theory at a time of depression when the lack of demand was the problem, and therefore his prescription involved public spending. And he did not propose anything much in the way of arresting inflation. Had he lived in the 70s, I'm confident he would have recognized the problem of inflation. It was inherent in his general theory that equilibrium will not give you the optimum, that there are less than optimum arrangements that can prevail. He called them equilibria. And of course, today we talk about multiple equilibria, which to my mind means that sometimes you're in disequilibrium. I call it disequilibrium. So I think he would have dealt with inflation, but because he didn't, monetarism came back into vogue. Milton Friedman was tremendously influential, and actually that was a revival of the monetarist theory that prevailed in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. Which then led to the great crash.
Was discredited by it.
So there has been a little bit of a repetition in history.
Well, and just the way the late 70s discredited to some extent Keynes.
Right, right.
Thank you very much. My name is Cecilia Björner, and I'm the Swedish ambassador here in Hungary. I think that my country is possibly a good example of where you have parted the market sphere and the political sphere, as you call it. And I would personally argue that that's one of the reasons why we have been relatively prosperous over a long period of time. However, we see almost the opposite trend in Sweden from your suggestion, and that is that we are having more market influence in the political sphere, and in some parts more political influence in the market sphere. So my question to you would be, how do you ensure an efficient use of resources in the political sphere if you don't have market principles or market ideas guiding the use of public funds? And the other side is, how do you make sure that the market side or the capitalistic side is taking responsibility for public common interests and goods if you do not have political influence in the sphere? And I'm thinking about the environment and the climate, of course.
A very big question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador. I'm reminded we have 4 minutes left, so if you can begin to answer that in four.
Please don't misunderstand me. in being in any way opposed to markets. I think markets are really a wonderful instrument for allowing adjustments, allowing feedback in particular, very important, that is neglected. Actually, I argued in my lecture for the minimum intervention from government in the form of regulation and intervention in the economy. One should give whatever the markets can do, should be allowed to do it because they do it much, much better than governments can.
Then you would do less than the Swedes do, presumably. Mm.
Well, I don't want to go into the Swedish situation because I don't know it well enough. Mm. Markets have a role, but there's also a need for political decisions, and markets are not designed to make those social choices. Markets are for exchange among market participants, and there are social needs and public goods and so on, which need to be provided by a political process. And generally, as I argued in my lecture, markets are actually more efficient than the political process. Therefore, we should leave it to them what they can do. But to claim that they can do everything just because they are more efficient is an exaggeration that has cost us very dearly.
Does anyone have a one-sentence question? We have 2 minutes left. I need your commitment to one sentence. Yes, sir, you get the prize.
Julius Horvath, Central European University. Can you comment on the relationship of market fundamentalism and the fall of communism? Because there...
The relationship between market fundamentalism and the fall of communism.
Well, the fall of the disintegration of the Soviet Empire could be interpreted either as the triumph of capitalism or the triumph of open society. And there were these two approaches. And actually, I took it to be the victory of open society over closed society. Others, like Václav Klaus, saw it as the victory of capitalism over... of course, I would argue my case.
This is certainly the most global audience that we have had in the four lectures to date, and I want to particularly thank our participants from Fudan University. It's also been, I think, in many ways, our most thought-provoking and debate-provoking lecture by our distinguished lecturer, and we are extremely grateful for that. Tomorrow, in his final lecture, Mr. Storos will bring together all the themes that he has been exploring with us this week, and he will show the way forward from our current enormous set of dilemmas, crises, and problems in many dimensions. So this will be an extraordinary moment for us when we return to this hall tomorrow. I'm very grateful to our moderator, Mark Danner, and once again, I invite you to join me in thanking George Soros for inspiring and provoking us with his thought and his thoughtfulness. Thank you.